Return to Northmoor. Episode 21. Running time, 33 minutes. Welcome to Return to Northmoor. This is Tim, and this time we're going to talk about friends and enemies. This is the overview of friends and enemies for the campaign as a whole, and ideally talking about the future of what you can do with people you have heard about and people you haven't yet heard about. Joining me again is Doyce.
Hello.
We're going to get right into this with some general goals around friends and enemies. The first goal I have is someone to roleplay with.
You obviously will be talking about the friends mostly. Theoretically, the more memorable roleplay scenes are going to be with the enemy. A lot of the roleplay is going to be with the friends that you have out there. The folks back in town or the old adventuring group. I've enjoyed in the past is having people who are curious about your characters and then that want something. It could be a very simple thing. Saying it that particular way is something that I was taught to say from running Dogs in the Vineyard. You're setting up a town. The whole idea is everybody in the town that you're visiting want something from your characters when they walk in. And it's not really a mystery. There may be people who are reluctant to tell you what they want or what other people are doing, but the facts are there. Asking the right questions, you'll get that stuff. And they want to tell you in the long run because that will provide justification for whatever it is that they want you to do, even if it's not even remotely realistic. By them wanting something from you, they elevate even young PCs to importance. Right.
And I think that translates universally into if you're going to have the NPCs tell the PCs something, they need to have a reason for wanting to tell the PCs.
Exactly.
If they don't, then it becomes Mr. Exposition, right? Well, I'm going to stand here and just tell you. So, for example, in Return to Northmoor, Renar unloads about this whole thing with the Star Temples and all that on them, which is a huge exposition scene. And the reason he's telling them is he really, really wants them to help get this figured out and get him and his friends healthy again. And he thinks now that he's seen their involvement that they might actually have a chance of doing so. Oh, it's completely self-serving. If I tell you all this, then you're going to have to know too, and by you knowing, you'll have to do something.
Everybody is self-serving. Everyone wants, everyone gives to get what they want. I like to follow a certain kind of pattern with that. I mean, it doesn't always work out this way, but sometimes people just need to jump right into that exposition. If you can manage to have a couple of conversations or even just one conversation with the NPC previous that doesn't have anything to do with that moment where they get a sense of the character, where, you know, they delve a little bit or they scratch just a little bit beneath the surface so that there's a sense that they have given a sonar ping to the PCs and taken their measure. And then when they come back to them in that next conversation and say, exposition, whatever that thing happens to be, then it feels as though there's some weight behind it where they've given this some consideration and now they want it. Rather than, the heroes have arrived in town. Allow me to press this button that releases all the exposition.
Although there is something weird about human nature that says that in a lot of ways, people are much more willing to trust a stranger with their tales of woe than they are someone they know, because it's not quite as much of a personal burden.
Right.
It's like, I'm not going to see you again tomorrow where you're going to have to hear about my tale of woe again.
It could just happen as the latter part of a longer conversation. I feel it's sort of that idea of the person wants to make sure that you're not a dick before they decide to entrust the saving of their wife, sister, daughter, MacGuffin thing.
Yeah, but there is a limit at which you're too close to them and they're not going to trust you because now you're wrapped up in it. Right?
Well, it could be that they're trying to assess to make sure that you are a dick before they give you the job.
Right, because that's what they may need to get it done.
I need somebody who's competent enough to do this who I don't actually care if they live.
It's like a Reservoir Dog saying, I don't want to make sure you're not too much of a nice guy.
Wait a second, your name is Mr. Pink? I have a message for you. You're exactly the person I need for this because I want you to die at the end.
And other than role-playing in terms of just giving you exposition and giving you a job or whatever else, there's something that you and I have been talking about lately, which is role-playing in order to help characters know more about themselves.
Exactly. You know, having the NPCs want to know about the characters. Person walks into town and they are, by any measure, they are heroes. They're exceptional. They're above the norm. People want to know about that. Men want to be them. Children want to grow up to be them. Women swoon, throw underwear. People are going to be interested in them to one degree or another. A priest in town might want to see where their moral compass points. So they ask questions. And in prepping for the first time the party arrives in town or the first couple days of the party's in a new area with three questions that each NPC could theoretically throw at one of the characters. Once the conversation is going, one of them is working very hard at the castle, and she's very young for the job because her mother's missing. And but before that even gets up, maybe she asks about the PC's mothers. Maybe she asks, what kind of influence did your mother have on you, or what does she think of what you're doing now? Or
although questions about mothers for adventurers always goes awry.
Well, sure, absolutely, it could go awry in a cool way. I mean, a lot of players will, having given this, my mother was killed by orcs when our village was wiped out, I was the only survivor, having done that 18 times, it might be more interesting to them. You know, my mom is actually very cool with this. I found out about fighting because she makes money as a seamstress and she embroiders tabards for the local militia back in our hometown. I was around them all the time because she was around them all the time. Mm-hmm. My uncle was in the militia. And first, they're going to remember the cook because the cook asked these questions. Then they're going to remember about the mother thing. And also, we get to find out about that character while he's sitting at the table making this stuff up about the character that you're asking.
So, and in 4th edition, D&D in particular, since there's not necessarily a story growth mechanic built into the game.
That's true, really, of any D&D iteration.
Right. And at the beginning of the game, the worksheets that we do get you so far.
Yes.
But then 2 or 3 sessions in, the worksheets are sort of played out, and you're off to the next thing. So what is it that can revitalize your personal feelings about your character? It's an NPC kind of probing you about things you may not have baked yet.
Exactly. With RTN's sheets, it's useful because you've seen the sheets, but the other players maybe at the table haven't.
Yeah, there's private stuff on
them. Yeah, absolutely. For the first couple sessions, when you have NPCs asking them questions, they might point at the things on the sheets. Things that you as the GM probably already know the answer to. Things that you as the GM, or as the players, probably already know the answers to, the player who's giving it. Shortly after that, or as you're starting to wind down on that, that's the perfect time to start to ask stuff that's not on the sheet. Because the sheets are great, but they're not deep. They're clear. They're a good portrait. But portraits aren't deep.
Well, and if there's anything we've learned about role-playing games over the years, is that 2-3 sessions in, everything you started with
is different.
Is different.
Yeah. No plan, including a character sheet, survives contact with the game. People always complain about how the GM's plot never survives contact with the players, but the same thing is true. Unless you get a guy who turtles up and says, you know, my character's never going to change. She's always going to be this mysterious lone wolf whose family was killed by orcs. You know, that's a red flag to a certain extent. I say that having been a guy who's made that character and viciously defended it for 25 sessions in a row. And I say that shamefully with, you know, not.
But it pridefully. Is a difficult balance because if you have someone who's immediately willing to change their character to match the group, then the group quickly becomes this sort of blah amalgamation with all the rough edges punched off, right? But if you have someone who rigorously sticks to it in the face of logic, like, why would you even be traveling with us if this is the case? That also is a problem. So finding that middle ground is a constant challenge.
The characters are going to change partly because the players are changing. I mean, time passes on these things. Return to Northmar was, how many sessions did you guys play?
Oh, like 30.
30. So 2 years.
Yep.
I have a different opinion about things today than I did 3 weeks ago.
Right.
Let alone 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And
well, especially when you have kids, the age of your kids completely controls your mood a lot of the time.
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to be playing the same character in 2 years that you're playing today. Even if you're really enjoying the game, you want that person to have changed. I've witnessed that long-time D&D game that I ran. Guy started out with a big, dumb, high-strength, half-ogre fighter. Because he didn't think the game was going to go that long. And he realized that it was, but he also realized he didn't want to really like start a new guy. So he methodically made this guy systematically becoming a warlord for the express purpose of destabilizing every ruling influence in the entire region. Mm-hmm. That was his goal, was to achieve true leaderless anarchy in the region. And he had reasons for it. And he had gone about at great length to become the kind of guy who could realistically affect that change and even smart enough to think of it. People want to do that. These questions sort of let you give them that depth.
It gives them the opportunity to seriously rethink their character at any given moment without having to sit down and do another worksheet or whatever else.
Some kid playing in the street that you get to talk to for a second because something happened and you find yourself talking to the kid in the street. The little kid's pet gerbil pig comes running up or,
hey, mister, where'd you get that big shiny sword?
That kind of stuff. The kid starts playing with this disgusting little street pet that he's got and he asks you if you've ever had any pets when you were a kid. It can be any question. That's where a lot of really great stuff comes from. And we find out more about the characters. The characters are more real. We care more about other people's characters, which means that when you do split the party, it's fine in the adventuring thing when you're slamming through the dungeon to say never split the party. It doesn't work in a social situation like a party to never split the party unless you're all girls and you're going to the bathroom. in those terms, when it splits up, you want there to be interest at the table in what Joe's character is doing, in what Kim's character is doing. So that when you're having a conversation with the Duke, everybody else is not completely tuned out.
There is a unheard scene in Return to Northmore that's in recordings that may never see the light of day. A huge party in the Eladrin Castle where Kim's character is the princess. And so she's off desperately trying to do political machinations. Whereas the other three fellows, not being Eladrin, Elvin, nor being any high-class people of any kind, are off sneaking around the castle, desperately trying to steal various items that they think are going to help them. And the cutscenes back and forth were very amusing, but it didn't make it into the recording very well, but we'll see. The last thing that I had is sort of a reason that we have friends and enemies.
We talked about friends a lot.
So let's talk about enemies. Is to be not only an antagonist in a combat sense. Of course, that's really not an enemy. That's really more of an obstacle course.
It's an obstacle,
And true enemy is someone who's the face of a larger problem. So the example that comes to mind is the smoking man from the X-Files.
Sure.
He was himself an enemy, but he was really the face of conspiracy.
Right.
Whenever you saw him, the word conspiracy jumped into your head. And so, yes, he was part of it, but he was the face of something much, much larger.
One that immediately leaps to mind for me is the operative from the Firefly-based Serenity movie, because the Alliance is big and cold and heartless and cruel because for the greater good that it sees and so forth.
That has an opportunity of letting that person convey the face of something faceless. Putting a face on it and making it be represented by a person gives you the opportunity to both generalize about it and to get very, very specific and make you wonder, is everyone in the conspiracy just like this? If so, is that an advantage I could maybe use, or what's the deal?
For me, when you've got that antagonist, the bad guy, I think for the sake of, this is a scary word to use in the context of gaming, but for the purpose of realism, to not just have a scenery chewing, I'm thinking Rickman in the Robin Hood movie from a couple years ago. For the purpose of having somebody who isn't just a scenery chewing bad guy who's evil for the because it's for the sake of evil.
Yes.
Or evil for the sake of, or doing bad things for the sake of the power that he's going to get, or his obsession with the beautiful ingenue or whatever that is. You should take a look at that bad guy's head and understand him in a way that lets you see how he is the good guy from his point of view. Realistic bad people, from their point of view, are the heroes of the story. And you should figure out a way to do that. Not to trot out some real life, but Saddam Hussein did not think of himself as a bad guy. He's not the bad guy. He's the leader of the people, you know, who's being oppressed and assaulted from all sides by these people who want him to fall and say, please, guys, don't get no angry letters about my support of Saddam Hussein. I'm saying this for the purposes of
storytelling,
of illustrating a bad guy. He's a fine illustration of a bad guy. He sees himself that way. A bad guy should see himself as, you think of the smoking man, he's got his reasons. Mm-hmm. He is doing what he is doing, even if it's distasteful, for those reasons, which he believes are good ones.
Yes.
If you look at that Firefly operative guy, he is a monster. He sees himself as a monster. He is a bad person doing what is necessary to protect all the people who can't do those terrible things. Yep. He is, in his mind's eye, the good guy.
Right. In the Dostoevsky Nietzsche sense, the Superman, who says, not only am I better than everyone else, but I have the guts to do what no one else has the guts to do.
Exactly. And even if they don't think that they're better than everybody else, even the little bad guys, even the thug who's not even the thug, even the snitch in the bar who's going to sneak off after the party's gone, he's got a reason for doing that. Most people, and you could have the occasional pitiable person who is doing bad simply because they don't think that they'd be able to do anything else, where they sort of even see themselves as scum. That's fine. But nobody realistic. You can get away with it in pulp, but in other genres, you really can't get away with a guy who's doing the mad laughter on top of the pinnacle simply because he enjoys it. He wants to be the guy clutching the crystal skull at the top of the plinth, and nobody wants to be that guy. They're willing to do it, and they may be even laughing maniacally about it because they think that they're about to achieve this good thing. You know, I need ultimate power
so that I can make the world a happier place.
Yeah. Or to quote Dr. Horrible, the world sucks, and I just want to control it.
So that's a good segue. So in our heroic tier, which for D&D is the first through 10th levels,
Yes.
The primary antagonist is going to be these Sahuagin, which is the shark men.
Right.
So they both serve as an antagonist in that they keep showing up over and over again, and they have their own goals. They're trying to accomplish things and so forth. But they're also a primary obstacle, right? So you're constantly fighting.
Right. I have to hand it to you for using, first of all, for pronouncing it correctly, or pronouncing it, even taking a shot at pronouncing it reasonably correctly, but just for using those. I don't think I've ever seen a D&D, there was one old D&D module, like when I was probably 15 or 16 years old, that had like...
Secret of Salt Marsh, the UK module, is that was the one that inspired me, is that it was just so great to have this seaside adventure where your actual villains are actual seaside monsters and not just orcs again.
And I gotta tell you, I hated that module because it involved underwater adventuring, and I hated running underwater adventures for D&D. I don't think I've ever had a campaign where like underwater stuff, it always seems like it's going to be cool and it always just sucks. But I have to hand it to you for using those guys. It was a real nice departure from the norm.
Yeah, that was actually my first commitment, was that I'm not going to use orcs and kobolds and everything else at first level, because I'd done that. I'd done it 100 times and I was ready to move on. Ironically, my players were like, I just didn't understand why first level didn't have kobolds. I would have known what to do. But, you know, that was the whole point. You know, it's something different, right? They're the antagonist for the first half, but there's also what I would call the transitional antagonist. So this is the person who's sort of pulling you up into the next level and is going to bridge you on into the
Paragon sphere. Who's in charge of, who's giving the fishmen their... Right. I'm not even going to take a stab at pronouncing
the
that.
The Sahuagin. Amara is one of the former adventurers. So they have, you know, their mentor and Renar and all those guys. There's a whole suite of these former adventurers, and all of them together have their own twisted tale to tell. And one of the things I like about having a group of adventurers as sort of frenemies in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, frenemies. I'm glad you brought that word out before
I did. Is that it gives you a lot of lessons to learn. It's like, well, this is what happened when they did stuff, so it makes you think twice about something that you might just run into. Well, like, oh, well, wait a minute. When they did this, it worked out poorly. So it gives you foreshadowing and foreboding that's easy to deliver.
Yeah, exactly.
So the old adventurers, you had, you know, Renar, the halfling ranger. You had the mentor, who was a human fighter type, could rearrange him.
The mentor, yeah.
Yep. And then you had the bog man, who's the druid. And then you had Amara, who was the wizardess. So what happened is when they went out on this quest for the king to go into these star temples, these big black obsidian temples, and retrieve an item, things went horribly wrong, and they ended up with these metal rods implanted in them, and all this horrible stuff happened. All of them took that a different way. The bog man retreated to the bogs and sort of decided he was going to live as a hermit. Renar decided, instead of being a ranger out in the forest, I'm going to become a barkeep so I can hang around with people. Yeah, all of this traumatic event, I just thought of it in terms of this huge trauma, what's going to happen. You know, and then the mentor went off to this remote outpost and decided to tutor other people, and he was going to pass his knowledge on since he couldn't do it personally, right? Those who can't teach, almost. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
But Amara went crazy, so she was sort of on the edge anyway.
And by went crazy, I think we could easily say she may, in fact, be insane and eating the flesh of the dead and talking to herself, that sort of thing. But a legitimate definition of went crazy might be doing incredibly horrible things and thinks she's doing the right thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because what she wants to do is she wants to get the rod, which is blocking her ability to use magic, out of her. If you think about magic in a deeper sense of, it's the ability to control the world around
or
you.
Or connect to the world, sure.
Exactly. And if you have that taken away, it's almost like being blinded and deafened and rendered completely powerless all at the same time, and yet still being able to be in the world. Yeah. And for someone who defined themselves as being able to use magic, to have all that taken away overnight.
Huge post-traumatic stress.
Yes, quick and dirty trigger to insanity.
Yes.
And a deep motivation to go and fix it, right? To go and say, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get this back. And I'm going to do whatever it takes to get it back for all of my friends as well. Because if we can just get these rods out of us, we can all be back to being friends again. And we can be back to being people, and we can go back to where we were, and everything could be like it used to be, which is a classic driver of irrational behavior.
She's not working towards the greater good, but she is working towards the selfish personal good, and she's the good guy. She's the hero. She's, in her mind, she's looking at things saying, I'm going to make this right for myself.
Right.
And I'm better than everybody else, and I can do things that other people wouldn't normally do, include command the fishmen to go eat people.
Exactly. So at the end of the recordings to return to Northmoor, Amara shows up and demands that they give her the key, because she's going to use this key to go unlock the temple and hopefully try to go farther. And they have a big battle, and they end up running her off, and she goes back and gathers more fishmen in the merchant guild and so forth to try to come back. And at the end of the heroic tier, she comes back, and there's a huge battle up at the outposts, which, you know, didn't make into the recordings. But the idea being that she continues to hound them and confront them as they work through the local area until finally there's a big showdown in the outposts. And in our version of it, Kim's character ends up throwing herself off the tower, sword in hand, you know, after smacking into Amara, and they're both going down. And of course, Amara, being a wizardess, she can't pull magic anymore, but she has all kinds of magic items, so she pulls out her ring of Featherfall, and suddenly Kim's character is falling at full speed, and she's not. So Kim's character hits the ground, takes all the damage, points the sword up, and, well, it's quite exciting, yes. That big battle with Amara kind of caps off the heroic tier, throughout which there's been encounters with her, with the Sahuagin, who we discussed, and with the Merchant Guild. Now, the Merchant Guild are another one of these bridge antagonists.
I'm going to stop you for just a second. Kim's a vet player.
Yes.
Okay. I was in a situation once upon a time, and I got a couple of eye rolls from the players about this, because I was playing. This was at a con, where we were trying to escape from this tower, and in order to accomplish this, I wasn't a spellcaster, but I had like a necklace of fireballs some idiot had left in my care. And I basically told everybody to run for the downstairs exit, and I would draw them off. I proceeded to do that by basically popping the entire necklace and throwing it to the bad guys just to basically make them angry, and then running up rather than down, because I'm a gamer. I had pulled a really nice little job with getting through a doorway so that if I made my save from the fireball, I wouldn't take any damage because it effectively gives you evasion, blah, blah, you know, all that kind of neat little tricks. And then proceeded to run up because the GM had mentioned that the tower was like 90 feet or 100 feet tall or something like that. Like,
but you're calculating
immediately
how much damage
in my head. I knew it was that would be 9d6 damage. And that's going to average out to about, you know, 27 points of damage or something like that. And worst case scenario, it's like 54, and I had 56 hit points.
Right.
I had about 45 at that point in time, and I knew I could survive a jump off the top of the tower unless everything went horribly awry.
Yes.
And so I just did. I just jumped off the top of the tower, and the GM was just staring at me going, but it'll kill you. I'm like, no, it won't. I'm a hero. Apparently it won't. I land in a tree. I land in a bush or something. But I only took like 13 points of damage. He rolled absolutely terribly. So I'm like, I landed a tree and then a bush. I don't know. Something. Did she do that? Did she know that she could survive the fall before she did that crazy
move?
Well,
the cool thing was, because we were playing 4E, no one had really done falling stuff at all. So we had no idea. So she was completely willing at that point, because
she
of
wanted
some
her
stuff
dead.
That happened, that she was willing to sacrifice herself to take him down. She was, of course, going to try to get Amara on the bottom and, you know, hopefully take the majority of the damage.
That's a good plan.
She would have been fine if she had died at that point.
Yeah.
She would have been totally
fine. I was just curious if she had, like, sort of done the math and going, you know, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to survive this jump.
You know, I'm sure that in the back of her mind, she had something like that going on.
Yeah.
But that's the cool thing about being a hero, is that you get to make those choices.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So back to the transition from heroic to paragon.
The other group that's involved is the Merchant Guild. And the Merchant Guild is your classic mercenaries. They literally are out to make money. They run stuff all over the place. And as a result of them doing trade, they've built up this sort of mini army to protect their caravans.
Sure.
And they decided, well, since we're in between caravans right now, we'll just rent out the mini army. And, you know, as a result, they become a combination of trade and mercenary guild.
Interesting. Okay. And so they're in the same area.
Yes. Well, they're in the same area because Amara has brought them there to try to deal with all of the stuff that's going on. And,
yeah, you don't hire Blackwater unless you expect Blackwater to affect the area. Blackwater is going to affect the area.
Exactly. So they are definitely Blackwater. Their work for Amara here, but their bigger interest is running the city, the big city that's sort of off in the haze during the heroic tier. And this big city...
off the edge of the map.
Yeah, exactly.
Here there be merchants.
Yes. They have taken over and sort of oligarchically run the city because the king has, for lack of a better word, sort of slacking.
Yeah.
He's not really paying attention to the city, and we find out later why. But they run the city, and as a result, they're constantly just trying to govern. And so even though Amara has hired some subsegment of them to go off and do her bidding, they, of course, answer to the bigger masters of, you know, the oligarchical rulers of the city.
Right.
So like most mercenaries, they're constantly switching sides and looking for the best deal.
Yeah,
so
backstabs. And so we get a little bit more intrigue at that level because we start dealing with bad guys who excel at that. And if you don't excel at that, they're going to burn you at that point.
Yes, and so what I wanted to do is set up literally a yin and yang of antagonists at this level, which is you have Amara, who's willing to do anything and is completely insane and is known to the PCs at some level. She's intimately right. tied to them because of their friendships.
The people that they're friends with have history with her.
Exactly. So in a lot of ways, she's almost a sympathetic figure. She's extremely tragic, and that everyone's like, wow, she was going to be this great wizardess and all this stuff happened. Maybe if we could help her, we could help cure her and she wouldn't be insane anymore.
And cure our friends.
Exactly.
Like the mentor. And
yes.
whatnot.
Contrasted with utter cold professionalism, which is that we do exactly what we're told. There's no discussion.
This
There's
isn't
no buying
personal.
Us off. This is not yeah. personal. Yeah, exactly.
You could ask Amara about her pet that she had when she was a child. Yes. And the new guys, they don't have pets when they were kids. They practice with abacus, and you know, they conducted surgery on their childhood toys.
Yes. They are purely soldiers, and many of them are very non-friendly people. They are the kinds of guys that can't live in the city. They can't hold other jobs. The only thing they're good at is killing people, and they find it.
And those are the mercenaries, and the merchants are worse.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, very much so. And what's funny is that the leader of the merchant guild here in the Lost Village area is a merchant,
right?
And he's very interested in sort of exploring the ruins and getting all these artifacts out of the ruins and the swamp. And the mercenaries, for by and large, are soldiers, so they're right. not necessarily happy tromping around. They'd rather be in a straight-up fight. So there's a lot of tension even within the merchant guild between I want to go get money and I just want to fight, and you know, whose master are we serving? And
right. How'd the players, I mean, how did everybody respond to that gear shift in terms of...
Well, it was
because Amara's dead at this point.
Well, so this is, you know, right at the gear shift. So Amara was dead. She's sort of utilized the merchant guild.
Right.
But now when they return to the city, and this actually is played up right at the end of where the recording stops, when they return to the Lost Village, the merchant guild has essentially taken over the town. And they've declared martial law. They have everything locked down. The guy who's the king's former sword teacher is now here as the military governor of the town and is searching for the PCs and all their friends.
Right.
So there's this very hard military lockdown, and now Amara seems like kind of a good thing. So in our game, they ended up making a deal with Amara to try to get them into the city to get the stuff they needed to go back to the outpost, and then of course things went south up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. She, you can cut a deal with her, but cutting a deal with the merchants involves a lot of money.
You might not kill her. She might not be dead. Your Northmar may vary.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So the whole idea of setting up these antagonists is to give the PCs a foil, but to also have someone who's running stuff in the background, so these obstacle courses have sort of a greater meaning and greater setup.
I used to have this happen all the time in some games, with very social. Amber game I've run a lot, but it's a very social game in terms of, because you don't have a lot else to do in terms of, you know, mechanics or anything like that. So a lot of it is what kind of social impact
right.
is going to happen here. I have on more than one occasion cut a game session short in that game when the players do something so mind-boggling or so impactful that I'm like, okay, we're stopping here. Because I need to figure out how all the NPCs are going to react to what just happened. What the players have told me about that game is that one of the things that they enjoyed about it the most was the sense that that stuff was going on even if we weren't there.
Right. The background is ticking away.
Exactly. I mean, they would decide to go and do something. You didn't get a random encounter. You ran into this guy in a time and place that was completely unexpected because I was keeping track of what he was doing, and you decided to go to the same place he was at the same time, and, well, crap. I guess we got to deal with him right now.
Yes. He's crossing paths with you.
Yeah, exactly. And that engendered a real sense of the world is living and breathing around you, and while you are important in it, you are not the only thing going
right.
on. And that's fun for those guys, for those merchants and that sort of thing. A lot of fun stuff that you can do there where you come back to that town that the merchants have taken over and somebody that you used to like is basically working with them because it's not like you guys were here and people have to eat. I've got to make ends meet, and so hell yes, I'm working with them.
So that covers sort of the major players at the heroic tier. Some minor players are the Bellaloquans. So they have these ghosts that are
right.
you know, the people who used to live here, and they're sort of a minor character, although some people who've played Northmar have told me they end up spending a lot of time talking with them, trying to find out about the history and what happened back in the old days, and chatting with them, and they spend a lot of time with that human-ghost interaction.
Well, it's sort of, I mean, you're exploring the sandbox at that point in time. If they're sort of conduits to past history and things like that, and the players are interested in that sort of thing, they have the means of exploring that in an in-character way,
right?
Which, again, is going to put the GM on that spot where it's like, well, tell me about your puppy that you had when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Except in this point in time, is tell me about the puppy that you had 300 years ago.
Yeah.
You're letting the GM sort of expound on that history and expand and make the world your own. It's a lot of that.
And it's interesting, the reports I've had of other people who've run Northmar have run the gamut from people talking to them, trying to say, hey, where was your biggest repository of treasure, you know, so that they try to find out where it might be so they could go there.
They're not asking about puppies.
Right. And yeah. Two people who are asking about puppies, like, what was culture like? Tell me what, you know, what your life was like back then and what the world was like.
Because did the mages really run everything? Was it? Yeah.
Yeah. Especially once the PCs have gone through the Temple of Art and felt that personal historic connection, like, I'm descended from these people.
Right.
Then going back and talking to them is really about, wow, I'm finding out my own family tree here.
Where did Kim's Elven Island, when did that come into it? Was that in the Paragon tier? Or?
Well, she actually had listed that that's where she was from, of course, back on the worksheet.
Right.
But then right after, as we're transitioning from Heroic to Paragon, is when we went off and did this sort of side adventure off in the Feywild.
Right.
And so that's what I was about to mention, is in addition to minor characters that are sort of on the path, there's all kinds of stuff you can do that is directly related to the backgrounds of the characters. If they have friends, acquaintances in the Lost Village, or like in Kim's case, off in the Feywild, what we ended up doing is running off into the Feywild and dealing with her personal sort of history stuff for quite a few sessions. And that was a great amount of fun, but it's not the kind of stuff that's directly on the path of the adventure
here. Right, yeah. It's letting the players' backstories be part of what is being resolved and dealt with. I don't know that there isn't going to be a point where there's just too many deltas for the material that's being provided to really be of value. At some point, you're doing what you do, even with Return to Northmoor material, you're doing what people a lot of times tend to do with modules, which is, I took the map and the challenges and stuff like that and renamed a bunch of people and made it about this other thing entirely because, you know, what this module, what this adventure is about isn't anything of interest to us, but if we change it and it's this guy who's at the end and blah, 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 then I can use it.
Right.
It handles the legwork with, but it's stripped out the story to paste in their story.
And so what I did is I added in a bunch of stuff that wasn't originally in my plan that said that the Belloquins and the Feywild were highly connected, and that at that time the veil was thinner and they went back and forth quite a bit.
Right.
And in fact, a lot of the stuff that happened to Belloqua, the Feywild was trying to prevent and trying to help them with. So all that stuff sort of sprung to life.
So you took it and tied it into the original, the vanilla Return to Northmoor setting.
Right.
It's a good idea, and it's an idea that everybody should do because it extends the life expectancy of usefulness of the campaign material. Yes. If you're tying what the players are giving you that may not have anything to do with the setting into the setting so that you can continue to use setting material that's being provided by you in sort of the official way and still have it have meaning to the players.
There is a careful line you have to tread before you go on to this cigar is just a cigar problem where suddenly now everything everywhere they go, no matter what, is tied into everything else.
Yeah, obviously you don't want to overdo it, but if you can, I mean, your example is a great example with the Feywild's connected to these people that were already part of the setting. Logically, it makes sense, but it doesn't touch everything.
At some point, it becomes like negative space in a design where you have to say, and at this point, it's definitely not connected.
Yeah.
And that almost becomes more jarring at some point.
The fruitful void in the middle of it.
So once you've sort of lumped in all those heroic tier antagonists, we've sort of bridged onto the Paragon tier, you've got hopefully stuff that comes from the players' backgrounds to liven up the story. I'm going to go ahead and stop it right there. We will pick up next time with a discussion of both the Paragon and Epic tier of friends and enemies. I just want to thank Doyce for joining me on this recording. And I wanted to give a shout-out to Jeffrey out in California, who's running his own Return to Northmoor game. I had a great chat with him on Skype the other night and hope everything's going well for him. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time. You've been listening to Return to Northmoor, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone. Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronolin's Tower, Legends of Kithelin Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten, used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronolin.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at spookyouthouse.com.